From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Major legislation aimed at life and death in the womb is poised to move off of Capitol Hill and onto President Bush's desk. On Wednesday, the House passed a law already passed in the Senate banning late-term or partial birth abortion. Both the Senate and the House are expected to soon approve what some are now calling Lacey and Connors Law, in memory of Lacey Patterson, 8 months pregnant when she was murdered in California. The Unborn Victims of Violence Act would make harming a fetus in a federal crime a federal offense. President Bush has pledged to sign both bills. The fetus is gaining significant new stature in American law. Anti-abortion campaigners want to extend more legal protections to what they call unborn children. Pro-choice supporters fear that the noose is tightening around Roe v. Wade. Up next on Point, the difficult fight over fetal rights. Is the murder of a pregnant woman a double homicide? And if it is, then what is abortion? If day-old embryos are granted legal protection, can legal abortion last in America? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Suzanne Smalley, writer for Newsweek magazine and co-author of this week's cover story, The War Over Fetal Rights. Good evening and welcome, Suzanne Smalley.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And with us from Albany, New York is Bonnie Steinbach, chair of the Department of Philosophy at the State University of New York, Albany, and author of Life Before Birth, The Moral and Legal Status of Embryos and Fetuses. Good evening and welcome, Bonnie Steinbach.
Hello. Good to be here.
And with us from Bethesda, Maryland, is Hadley Arkus, professor of political philosophy at Princeton University and author of Natural Rights and the Right to Choose. Good evening and welcome, Hadley Arkus.
Hi. Hello. It's good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Suzanne Smalley, if you would, walk us in first to what's going on Capitol Hill. Many states already have what are called fetal homicide laws. Now, for the first time, this is moving toward becoming federal law as well.
Right. 14 states already have such laws. Basically, if a mother is harmed, an expecting mother, and her fetus ends up dying in the assault, these laws create separate murder charges. Now, they're, with the Lacey Patterson case, in a federal law called federal legislation called the Unborn Victims of Violence Act is gaining a lot of momentum and is going to be voted on later this month. Mm-hmm. It's expected to pass, and this would just be, more example of many showing right now how things are changing and how perhaps abortion rights are being chipped away at. It's indirect relationship, but if you can create separate murder charges for the death of a fetus, then you are in some ways conferring rights to fetuses. The anti-abortion crowd would say, and even some legislators who may be pro-choice would say that you're taking the choice away from a mother, and that's where the murder charges come from. But either way, philosophically, it does raise a lot of questions.
Suzanne Smalley, just to be very clear about this, the act that's now being considered on Capitol Hill, I'm missing the name of it here, the Unborn
Victims of Violence.
Yes. This would not make fetal homicide the law of the land. This would apply to a fetus killed in the commission of a federal crime or on federal property, like a federal a post office or a military base. Is that right? It's not as though it imposes this across all 50 states. Whenever a fetus dies or is harmed in the wounding or killing of a pregnant mother.
Right.
It falls within federal jurisdiction right now.
Hadley,
there's no alteration, no enlargement of federal jurisdiction.
Right. But, Hadley Arkus, does this constitute a bolstering of what are commonly understood to be fetal rights?
Oh, absolutely. But see, you curiously mentioned the case where the mother hasn't decided, but let's take the most interesting case here under the Unborn Victims of Violence Act is that Mrs. Robbins, who was beaten up by her husband in the Air Force, I think it was, she did want a child, and the child was killed mm-hmm. as she was beaten up. And yet the judge advocates group didn't think they could prosecute for the killing of the child. Now, Zoe Lufkin and others pulled on the ideological screen and said, well, no one was killed. I think the question for Ms. Smalley and others is, well, wait a minute. Are there some objective facts that bear here? was someone actually killed in this search, in this thing? Zoe Lofkin simply wants to see this as an assault on the mother. Now, to the extent that you do recognize that there is an entity there whose life was snuffed out, well, yes, you are putting in place the recognition of standing in the law for the protection of the unborn child, as you have in many other instances when a child can inherit property or an unborn child in the womb has standing against a negligent driver.
Bonnie Steinbach, let me put it to you then. Yeah. If that kind of standing is extended to the fetus, if the death of a fetus is a fetal homicide, then what is abortion? Can abortion stand alongside that kind of classification for the criminal death of a fetus?
Well, let me just back up for a second, because there was something that Mr. Arcus said that I would like to comment on, and that is the law's recognition of the unborn in terms of inheritance rights. The way the law has always been traditionally is that those rights take effect upon the live birth of the individual. You can't inherit in the womb if you're not born alive, and not just for the obvious reason that there's nobody there to get the money, but also in terms of the who would get the money next. So there's always been recognized in Anglo-American law this notion of live birth.
But now, can the death of a fetus be a murder and a legal abortion at the same time? If on the one hand it's a murder, can in other circumstances it be seen as a legal act because the mother wishes to terminate that pregnancy?
Well, I think that it certainly, once you recognize it, if you say that it's a homicide, that certainly does seem to be giving full legal status to the unborn. There may be other intermediate things to do. For example, we also have Buster's Law here in New York, which was a law that if you kill an animal in a cruel way, I'm not sure exactly the wording of it, you can be prosecuted, because it used to be the case that animals had no status. Well, increasingly animals are coming to have intermediate status. They're not full-fledged persons, but on the other hand, there are some penalties. That's one way to go. Another way to go is to, which a number of states have, I mean, we're talking about this now because of recent legislation and recent cases, but this is nothing new. I mean, in the early 70s in California, there was a case in which, there were a couple of cases in which women were viciously beaten, and sometimes with the intention of killing the fetus or causing the woman to miscarry, and there was no legal way to show that that was a more serious crime than simple assault. So one way to go about it is to say that if you attack a pregnant woman knowing that she's pregnant, or even more so with the intention of causing her to have a miscarriage, that's a much more serious crime and should be recognized as such, in part because you are depriving her of that very much wanted child. Now,
it shifts the focus, doesn't it? The wrong is not done to the life that was extinguished. It was done to the person who apparently wanted the satisfactions of motherhood.
That's exactly right. And so what it does, and correctly in my view, is it says that the one with full moral and legal status is the woman. She gets to make the decision. If she decides that she does not want to carry a pregnancy to term, she does not want to become a mother, she has the right, and unfortunately it's now still a legal right, that may change, to make that decision. But it is completely consistent with that to say, but nobody has the right to take that away from her by beating her and causing her to have a miscarriage.
Bonnie Steinbach, Hadley Arcus. Bonnie Steinbach, I just want to ask, is that saying then that the... In your view, it is the mother who determines whether this is a human life in the womb or not?
No, that is not my position.
All
my
right.
position is, and very much along with Roe v. Wade, the justices said, never in our legal system has the unborn been recognized as a full legal person. And they looked at the inheritance, and they looked at all of these
yes.
things. And they said, you know, you have to be born alive. So what I'm saying is that within our tradition, or perhaps objectively to use that kind of language, the fetus is not a full legal person. But given that, there may also be things that it would be wrong to do. And one of the things that it's wrong to do, it seems to me, is to deprive the woman of her choice to have this child. So I agree completely with Mr. Arcus that the wrong in this case is the wrong to the woman. Now, there may also
That wasn't my position. I was just pointing out the shift in the focus.
Right. May also be... I completely understand that. Now, there are other cases where it's a little more difficult, like, for example, the Lacey Peterson case, because she was murdered, and therefore, you know, there is no person who is suffering the loss of a wanted child. In that kind of a case, what I think the way to explain it is to say, this was a fetus so close to birth that all of our societal impulses kick in, just in the same way as Roe v. Wade prohibits, or doesn't prohibit, allows states to prohibit abortion after viability. So we may also say that there's a social reason to say that the killing of a nearly born child is a wrong and should be recognized as a wrong and punished in some way, even if the mother is not around to suffer the loss.
Suzanne Smollett, I want to ask you, Suzanne, if you could just put this in the context of the political contest over abortion. How do anti-abortion groups see this progress on fetal rights, in this case around harm or murder? How do pro-abortion or pro-life groups see it?
This law is really stirring things up on the Hill. And one quick point in response to what was just said is that, you know, the Lacey Peterson case is fueling the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. There is no doubt that it is gaining tremendous momentum because of Lacey Peterson's death.
Her family has actually asked that the bill be named after Lacey and the unborn
Connor's
child.
Law. And Americans across the country are very touched by this case, and no doubt several congressmen have received calls from people that never would have weighed in, perhaps, if Lacey and her unborn child hadn't died. But what is important to note is that this law will apply to a child in utero who is harmed or killed at any stage of development, not necessarily at the 8.5 months that Connor Peterson was at.
So not a fetus that's near birth, and not even, it's a murder in this case when the murderer had no idea the woman is pregnant.
Right, exactly, which, you know, issues raise questions. Now Pro-Choice America President Kate Michelman is very worried. She accused lawmakers of exploiting the tragic case. She called it crass and offensive, the tactics. And she actually, to quote her, said it's part of a larger strategy to establish the embryo with separate, distinct rights equal to, if not greater than, the woman. Their abortion rights folks realize that they are, fighting an uphill battle here, and that their row is getting chipped away at slowly. She did call us back, though, after having said that, apparently fearing that she might have sounded a little callous. And she wanted to stress later that she did realize that terminating a wanted pregnancy is an especially heinous crime, and that would deserve enhanced penalties. You can see that even the typically black and white abortion rights crowd is dealing with this issue with nuance. It's a very complicated matter, and nobody wants to sound like they don't appreciate how difficult it would be for a woman to lose a wanted baby in an assault.
Absolutely.
The pro-life crowd, on the other hand, is just as clear-cut in their views. They think that there's no question that this law should pass, that it's a no-brainer.
Do they see it as a step toward taking down Roe v. Wade?
I don't think that they come out and say it quite that bluntly, but they do definitely support the law as one more way of getting, you know, rights for fetuses.
But I remember Ronald Reagan in the 80s, and some of the anti-abortion campaigners, I think even recently, have said, look, how can it be murder when it's an assault and not murder when it's an abortion?
Well, that's what Ken Connor, the president of Family Research Council, which is viscerally anti-abortion, said to us. His question was, it's not okay for a husband to kill his wife's child, but it's okay for a mother to have an abortion.
Hadley Arcus, Suzanne Smollett, Bonnie Steinbach, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're looking at the fight over fetal rights and the hard-charging move to make the fetus a person in the eyes of the law. Almost from the moment of inception, you can join the conversation. If a pregnant woman is shot dead and her baby dies too, How many murders have there been? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the fight over fetal rights and the changing status of the fetus in the eyes of the law. You can join the conversation tonight. Is an unborn victim's law aimed at justice or aimed at Roe v. Wade? If fetal homicide laws protect a fetus almost from the moment of inception, how long can legal abortion last in the United States? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. The House is expected to pass the Unborn Victims of Violence Act this month. The Senate is expected to follow. The bill makes it a separate crime to harm or kill a fetus, even days after conception, when a federal crime is committed against a pregnant woman. Earlier, I spoke with the sponsor of the House bill, Congresswoman Melissa Hart, Republican of Pennsylvania. I asked her to describe the significance of the Unborn Victims of Violence Act.
It accords the import of the Violent Act against both mother and child, which I think is extremely important because, unfortunately, a lot of these violent acts are perpetrated against pregnant women even because they're pregnant, which I think is a horrible thing. But we found some statistics showing that the number one cause of death actually among pregnant women in a couple of states that kept those statistics was actually homicide. So it really does accord, I think, a correct punishment for the crime.
Melissa Hart, how, in your mind, if and when this becomes law, would this statute coexist with American abortion law that permits, obviously, the ending of the life of a fetus? How do these things stand side by side? On the one hand, it's murder. On the other hand, it's a legal medical procedure.
Well, that's the difference. You have a violent act committed against a woman that has nothing to do with a medical procedure, and it's being prosecuted.
But you're according the status to that child of full civil rights that, as I understand...
No. It's not a full civil right. We are according a crime to a person who perpetrates a crime against a woman who is carrying an unborn child. It's not according anything other than that.
If this law passes, do you think it makes abortion laws in the United States, as they currently stand, makes Roe v. Wade itself less sustainable?
No, I think Roe versus Wade stands on its own, completely separate from this.
You don't see any contradiction there? You don't think the courts will either?
I don't expect that the courts will. The whole purpose of this has been tested in a number of states already. There was a conviction recently in Pennsylvania where a woman actually beat another woman when she found out that the woman was carrying her boyfriend's child. And the very reason for the attack was the fact this woman was pregnant. I think that that is a very serious crime, and I think it should be treated as a murder, which was what was intended by the woman as she attacked the pregnant mother.
But you know that there are some among supporters of this legislation that do see it as helping build a ramp to the eventual abolishment of abortion. Do you think they're misguided?
I haven't really looked at it from that direction. I know that some people, and many people, in fact, there was a Newsweek article that was pretty extensive this past week that examined science, advances in science, and how children who are born more and more premature are able to survive. And I think that certainly draws a question about when abortion should be allowed and that sort of thing. And we just certainly had that debate this week regarding the partial birth abortion ban. But I don't see it as something that is incontrovertible.
So it's a hot issue, though, in Congress right now. Representative Melissa Hart, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Congresswoman Melissa Hart of the 4th District in Pennsylvania is sponsor of the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. She spoke with us earlier from Mercer County, Pennsylvania. We're looking tonight at the fight over fetal rights. My guests are Hadley Arkus, professor of political philosophy at Princeton, Bonnie Steinbach, professor in philosophy department chair at State University of New York, Albany, and Suzanne Smalley, who was the reporter on the article in Newsweek cited just there by the congresswoman. Hadley Arkus, let me put it to you. Do you see the emergence of this kind of fetal homicide legislation chipping away at Roe v. Wade, logically, inevitably, or not?
Sure, logically. Precisely for the question that you articulated about 10 minutes ago, when you raised the question of, do you think that the standing of the child in the law depends, whether it's a human being and an entity qualified for the protection of the law, simply depends on whether the mother wants her or not, or is there any objective standing to the child? to the extent that you recognize that there really is an entity there, of course you're putting in place premises at odds with Roe versus Wade.
But the court
wait. I've been holding back for a long time. I hope people give me a chance to speak now.
Have your whack.
Look, this is a harder case for the pro-choice people precisely because you're dealing with a case like the Robbins case or the case of Mr. Lenz, who lost his wife and unborn child at the Oklahoma City bombing, where people wanted the child. And you still have people like Zoe Lofgren and Kate Michaelman getting up and saying, even though the mothers wanted the child, we can't risk giving any standing to the children in the law unless for fear that we will undercut the critical premise necessary to Roe versus Wade. Now, the kind of contradiction that we're living with the law is one we've seemed to have lived with unaccountably for years, as with the case of in Washington, D.C., where I spent a good part of my life, where a judge incarcerated a woman who was pregnant because out of concern that she will affect her unborn child with her heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm.
But that same woman had the chance to end her incarceration instantly by invoking her claim to have her right to abortion and sweeping away the child whose concern provided the very predicate on which the judge incarcerated the woman. We've been living with these contradictions for a long while. The uneasiness over this comes precisely because you're dealing with cases under this bill in which the pregnant woman wanted the child. There's no question of an unwanted child, a wanted child, and yet the argument of the hard pro-abortion people must be we cannot recognize that anything happened other than an assault on the woman. We can't recognize that someone was actually killed in these circumstances, because if we recognize that, yes, we do imperil the very premise on which Roe versus Wade is built.
Bonnie Steinbach, let me put that to you then. If this eventually gets to the Supreme Court again and this legislation is there, does this lean another stone against the door on abortion rights?
Well, I think it's a little disingenuous to say that it is the pro-choice people who are saying we can't possibly recognize crimes against pregnant women for fear of undermining Roe v. Wade, when it is the pro-life people who are saying it's a contradiction and who are themselves therefore undermining it. It seems to me that it doesn't have to be a contradiction, and certainly you can recognize there's an entity there. Nobody says that when a woman has a huge belly, there's nothing inside there.
Mm-hmm.
The question is not whether there's an entity there. The question is the moral and legal status of that entity. And as I said before, you know, you can have intermediate moral status. Now, it seems to me,
but this is a dynamic issue. I mean, intermediate on the way to something is quite possible.
Right.
Kate Michaelman with NARAL says it's part of a larger strategy to establish the embryo with separate, distinct rights equal to, if not greater than, the woman.
I think that politically there is no question that that is what is going on. But I think it's very important to remember that there are two parts of the abortion debate. Part of the abortion debate is about the moral and legal status of the fetus. But the other part is that fetus is growing inside a woman. It is not existing all by itself, and the question is, can somebody come over and kill it? The question in abortion, the other half of the question is, do women have an obligation to continue a pregnancy at whatever cost, whether physical, emotional, social, whatever, to themselves?
Yeah.
We've made so far a social decision in this country and in most other industrialized countries that women do have the right to make that decision for themselves. The state isn't going to make it. Their husband isn't going to make it. The church is not going to make it. They can make it for themselves.
Will the passage of this legislation push the United States off of that trajectory, off of that kind of understanding?
Well, there are two questions that you could be asking. One is, politically, what's going to happen? And, you know, that's really beyond my area of expertise. I'm a philosopher. I'm not a social scientist. I don't know what's going to happen. I think, though, that it's not unreasonable for pro-choice people and, you know, Kate Michaelman and people like that to be very concerned that that's what's going to happen. Does it have to philosophically, ethically? No, I think it is possible to say both that a woman has the right to complete her pregnancy and have the much-wanted child, and therefore it should be punished. Do I think it should be punished as a homicide? No, because I think that does suggest an independent legal status. I would much prefer the route that other states have taken, which is in terms of aggravated assault.
And Suzanne Smalley, let me put it to you, just a political reality check here. Do the anti-abortion forces in Washington and around the country with this legislation, with potential vacancies coming up on the Supreme Court, are they licking their chops now and saying, hey, we are about to accomplish this. We are within range. They've been pushing for a long time. Is it happening?
There's no question this feels like a turning point to them. And Michelman and then her pro-choice allies suspect that the conservatives' movement to protect fetuses is all part of a plan by the Bush administration to lay extensive legal groundwork to upend Roe. George Bush himself has spoken out in favor of the Unborn Victims Act and against destruction of embryos for medical research. In the past year, his administration has expanded the state children's health insurance program to cover children from, quote, conception to birth to age 19, end quote. And he's even added embryos to a list of vulnerable human research subjects.
So like pretty soon abortion looks like a kind of island of exception in the midst of all this extension of a status to the fetus.
Roe's being upheld 5-4, and there's judges who are expected to retire. I think that there is a palpable sense of excitement in the pro-life community.
I'm going to let our callers come in. Adam's calling from Brookline, New Hampshire. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Hey. This is a very interesting subject, and it's something that people have dealt with ever since we've been trying to define what makes humans special and where that line is between us and not us. And I think even people that are pro-life realize that there is a continuum here between what's a child and what's a fetus, and everyone ultimately draws a line somewhere right now.
Some of the pro-life camp draws that line awfully early. I mean, some of these things we're talking at the embryo stage.
Well, yeah, and that's where my question comes in, because it seems like, to take it in an extreme, like someone had a story about someone that it was on a drug addiction and they were, their child was protected. Unless an actual definition is created of what's a human and what's not a human and why that is the case, I mean, you can go down an extreme. I mean, is a good Samaritan that breaks up a rape, is that a case of murder of the fetus? That's an absurd sort of situation, but, I mean, it's dangerous with certain types of logic, because they create ridiculous situations like that. So my question distilled is, where are people saying that the line is? Because ultimately there's a line somewhere, and why is that line there?
We got it, Adam. Thank you. Hadley Arkus, let me put that to you.
Well, unfortunately, we're well beyond Aristotelian biology. No one has the assumption any longer that the unborn child or the offspring moves from a vegetable to an animal to a rat. It is human at any stage. We understand that. We know that the lawyer is not more human than the youngster coming up, the newborn or the child in first grade. So the question is, what is the ground on which you say that a Homo sapiens, a human offspring, is less human at any in a particular stage? And of course, you don't have the same franchise that you have when you're a grown up or you're a college graduate. But the question is, do I have that minimal right not to be killed simply for the convenience of other people? That, as I've said before, is not really variable by height, weight, and how far along you are. So the critical point is, we know now that the unborn child or the offspring of Homo sapiens never undergoes a change of species.
But this isn't what Roe v. Wade hinged on, was it? Roe v. Wade was balanced on the 14th Amendment, on equal protection under the law, that the woman, the mother, should have access to that treatment.
But it's still dependent on the 14th Amendment casts its protections over persons. And so the question, of course, it would rise to why doesn't it protect this person within the law? So, I must say there was a certain mistake in Professor Steinbuch's construction. The law in the 19th century, as James Moore explained in his work on abortion in America, was geared explicitly to the protection of the unborn child as a human being. And James Wilson, in his first lectures on jurisprudence, one of our founders, a member of the first Supreme Court in 1790, explained that the common law cast its protections over the unborn child from the first stirrings, as soon as we know that it's there. So the question is, what's the ground of principle on which you claim at any stage that the human being at any stage is wanting it's something necessary to its standing as a human being to receive the protections of the law? As I've said before, can't be because it isn't speaking, deaf mutes aren't speaking.
the critical point here is that the people who try to say that, well, it's human, but it's not, doesn't have the standing of human beings, depend on some attribute, something they're attributing to the organism, that really doesn't have any effect on its standing as a human entity.
Bonnie Steinbach?
Well, Hadley Arkus and I disagree about moral and legal status. For him, the important thing is that the unborn doesn't change species. That's certainly something I wouldn't deny. But it seems to me that in order to have moral status, you have to be the kind of being that has some kinds of interests. And if you go back right to the beginning of fertilization, for example, you have something that is biologically different from either the sperm or the egg, but it is not in terms of whether it has any interest. It seems to me it doesn't have. It doesn't have any consciousness. It doesn't have any awareness. It can't feel pain. So I think it makes perfectly good sense to say, for example, that this is something where there's a woman here, and she has interests, and therefore, as a society, we're going to determine that she has the right to make those decisions, even at the cost of the life of the unborn. I just don't think an embryo compares. Now, I'm a gradualist on abortion, and so it seems to me that it's perfectly reasonable also for society to say, well, you got to make up your mind within a certain amount of time. And the closer we get towards birth and the more it's like a newborn baby, it can hear, it's sentient, it can feel, that we're going to put some restrictions. I think that's perfectly reasonable to say. But I don't think it's just a matter of its biological status, that it is biologically human.
Okay, but we can feel all this being put back on the table. I want to get another call in before the break. Lisa's calling from Boston. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Good to have you.
I listening to this debate, it actually put a cognitive spin on something that has made me angry in my profession for a long time. I'm a physician. I'm a pediatrician and
right.
the director of a large well nursery at in Boston.
Okay.
And I, you know, will not infrequently have newborns who have been subjected to their mother's cocaine use throughout the pregnancy or mm-hmm. heroin use.
Mm-hmm.
And these children have been harmed. Their futures have been diminished, and they are often in pain.
And you're angry, and you want some justice done.
And
you want some punishment for the mother. Is that what you're getting?
You know, I think my emotional response has always been, my goodness, you know, these poor little guys. If anybody had done this to a person who wasn't a fetus, they would be held liable. But in these situations, there's some protection.
So as a woman, Lisa, what are you feeling? Bring it on, more rights for the fetus, and what about abortion rights in that case?
I don't know. I've been, for decades, I've been a pro-choice activist. So it's a bit of a mind warp.
It really is a mind warp, and it's being brought back right front and center. Lisa, thank you for your call. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the fight over fetal rights and the hard-charging move to make the fetus a person in the eyes of the law, almost from the moment of inception. You can join the conversation. Be honest. Do you feel conflicted about this? How do you build the logical case that makes killing a fetus in a mugging a murder and killing a fetus in an abortional clinic A-OK? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the fight over fetal rights and the hard-charging move to make the fetus a person in the eyes of the law, almost from the moment of inception. You can join the conversation. If American fetuses are given such protection, can American abortion rights stand? Do fetal rights doom abortion rights? And what about the woman? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight from State University of New York, Albany, Bonnie Steinbach, from Princeton, professor of political philosophy, Harold Arkus.
Hadley Arkus.
Hadley. And joining us from New York tonight, Suzanne Smalley, reporter for Newsweek and co-author of this week's cover story in Newsweek, Should a Fetus Have Rights? David's calling us right now from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David. You're on the air. Good evening.
I have a way to give the fetus full rights from conception, yet give the right of the mother for abortion.
Let's hear it.
Okay. what a mother is doing is aiding a life into the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, without the mother, that fetus would never come to birth.
Mm.
Just like someone drowning in the middle of a lake, if I go and swim and bring them in, I'm aiding that person.
Well, of course, at this point in technology, people would say, well, it's true to a point that the fetus needs a mother. After a certain point, it doesn't.
Well, true, but it's still. And early on,
mm-hmm.
you don't know the risk, what I call it. Like the same as a person standing on the shore. If they jump into the lake to swim all the way out to grab a person drowning
mm-hmm.
coming in,
mm-hmm.
they don't know if they're going to rescue it. They might end up drowning themselves. Just as women, there's quite a few women who die in childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a risk they're taking on.
So you bring it back and look at it as the mother's, the pregnant woman's enterprise here, putting that above the other issue. Suzanne Smalley, I want to ask you, I mean, you hear David here reaching for a way to find this balance. We see from opinion polls so many Americans support abortion rights unless at the same time at the same time you hear these cases of pregnant women dying and the fetus dying, you can't help but be touched by it. We heard Lisa, our earlier caller, a supporter of abortion rights but feeling conflicted. Do you see this kind of conflicted sense spreading, and why is it spreading now? I mean, these are human conditions that have been around for decades, forever.
Well, I think that that's a great question, and there's no doubt that recent dramatic breakthroughs in fetal and reproductive medicine have added a lot to the emotional confusion that many people are feeling about this highly emotional issue. You know, once just grainy blobs on a TV monitor, now fetal ultrasound images allow parents to see tiny fingers and toes, and that's got to have an effect. We now can also do much more sophisticated surgery in utero, lessen the harmful and debilitating effects of a disease like spinal bifida. There are fetal photo shops that are around the country that parents can go and see their fetuses.
And parents they put up the sonogram as the first portrait of that offspring.
And it definitely is having an effect. We did a polling tied to this story, and we were definitely impressed by the shift that we saw. Only 11% of people told us that they believe that life begins at birth. 46% said that they believe life begins at conception, and an additional 12% said that they believe life begins when the embryo implants in the uterus.
And what percent support abortion?
We didn't ask that question, but I can tell you that it's probably going to conflict with the set of numbers I just gave you.
Right. So there's a kind of internal contradictions in people.
But I don't think it really does conflict.
Bonnie Steinbach, please.
Because of what I said before about there being two halves, and this sort of relates to what David was saying too. Part of it has to do with the status of the fetus. It's not really a question of when does life begin, because obviously it's alive, and in fact even before conception you have living sperm and living eggs,
the elements of life.
But there's also the element of the pregnant woman, and so I think what Americans, and maybe not, it may be groping towards a way to articulate it, are saying is, yes, it's true that there is this entity there. It's human. It has the potential to become a human person just like you or me on the one hand. And on the other hand, there's this woman who would have to undergo the burdens of pregnancy, who might take some physical risks. Not many women die in pregnancy, but some do, and some have very burdensome physically pregnancies, or it might turn her life upside down. So I think what Americans are trying to accommodate is both sides of this equation, and that's why I don't think it is a contradiction to say that there is a living entity there. On the one hand, yes, they're saying it isn't that it just becomes alive somehow when it gets born, but at the same time, that the right to decide whether or not to continue a pregnancy belongs to the woman.
But politics, Suzanne Smalley, I think are pushing against that perception. I mean, in the late-term abortion, the partial birth abortion bill, as I understand it, even if the mother's or the pregnant woman's health is in danger, that procedure is no longer permitted, period. Is that correct, once it's signed?
First of all, partial birth abortion is, definitely a loaded term. And, you know,
so many of these terms
to
are loaded.
Type of abortion that's I think a lot of people don't know exactly what a partial birth abortion is. It's a very strange sounding, jargony phrase. It's basically an abortion that is used to terminate pregnancies in the second and third trimester, and the procedure is medically known as intact dilation extraction, and it's rarely used according to the American College.
You don't explain what it is. You keep mentioning, but you don't. Why don't you just explain what it is?
Yeah. Why don't you go ahead, since you
The New York Times said the abortion of. Look at what Martin Haskell, the practitioner of the procedure, how he described it. You insert, you puncture the skull of the child. You remove the contents of the brain, so the child can be drawn out virtually intact, so to speak, in one piece. The problem about the health exception is that as the testimony came during the hearings, and as the AMA,
the health exception being the mother's life is in danger.
That this kind of procedure is almost never indicated. And you might ask the ordinary woman on the street, what kind of a threat would you have to face before you would find your remedy by puncturing the skull of your child and sucking the brains out?
But if there were such a threat, one can well imagine the woman and the man and the entire family saying, let's do it. I want to get some more calls in here. Adrian's calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Adrian. You're on the air.
Yes. I want to suggest that it's important to support the notion that ending a wanted pregnancy is a serious and tragic event. At the same time, that ending a wanted pregnancy is not the same thing as killing a born human person.
A born human person.
Right. And I think that it might be valid to think about ending a wanted pregnancy by someone else, by the beating of a woman or the murder of a woman, or a deliberate act to harm a woman to end the pregnancy, is something like a hate crime. It is doing something to the woman to get at something else, to get at the fetus.
And we can all understand intuitively the difference between the death of a wanted and an unwanted or untenable pregnancy.
Yes, but that's not the same thing as granting the fetus the same status of the born, existing human person. It acknowledges that the fetus is alive. It acknowledges that the fetus has potential. It says that ending a life that a woman wanted is a tragic thing. It is an aggravated event to a woman without granting the fetus the status of a born human person.
What is the moral shift to birth? It hasn't undergone a change of species. The child is recognizably in the sonograms.
I have an answer to that.
Yeah.
If fetuses could live in artificial wombs and could be transferred from human women to artificial wombs within 2 weeks or 2 days or 2 months, then we would have a different conversation about the status of the fetus. But right now, fetuses can live only in women, and there is no reason, if women are not required to provide kidneys to their three-year-old children, and they are not, and neither are men, there is no reason to require that a woman use her body to make sure that an entity she doesn't want to come to birth comes to birth.
Adrian, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Our time is running down. Hadley Arcus, I'll give a last word to you there, just 10 seconds here.
Well, first of all, we're dealing with many cases here in which the pregnancy is quite advanced. But once again, you're talking about the nature of the entity. Whether that unborn child happens to be dependent on others or not for its sustenance really does not affect the nature of what it is.
So we talked about the fetus a lot tonight, but there remains the issue of the woman, and we can hear the country's struggle to balance all the interests. Hadley Arcus, Bonnie Steinbach, Suzanne Smalley, you've all been great. I want to thank you for coming on.
Okay, you're welcome.
Suzanne Smalley is a reporter for Newsweek magazine. Bonnie Steinbach is professor and philosophy department chair at State University of New York, Albany, and author of Life Before Birth, The Moral and Legal Status of Embryos and Fetuses. And Hadley Arcus, who joined us tonight from Bethesda, Maryland, is professor of political philosophy, Princeton University, and author of Natural Rights and the Right to Choose. You can continue this conversation online at onpoint.radio.org. In a moment, a 17-year-old West Virginia boy spins the state's biggest yarn. This is On Point. Forget the flat-footing competition or the lap dulcimer contest. The real barn burner at the annual Vandalia gathering in Charleston, West Virginia, is the Liars Contest. It's standing room only every year. Maybe it's the little kid in all of us who still thrills to fudge the truth, or the pleasure of feeling an audience squirm through a real humdinger. 17-year-old Charlestonian Justin Wood scooped up the biggest liar title for the second year in a row. His whopper also got him a cash prize of $100 and a golden shovel as a trophy. In this radio diary, Justin Wood spins a little of his winning yarn and tells us about his plans for making a dishonest man of himself.
Lying is just kind of a natural thing. It's not so much that you're lying to get out of trouble for me. It's that I like to lie to just make things more interesting. When I talk to my teachers and when I talk to my mom and my dad and tell them what I'm doing, sometimes they think I'm lying, and I'm going to tell you that I usually am. The lie I just won on was I had won the year before for the youth contest, and I lied about how my mom is always right, and that was just kind of a way to get back at her, and how I was attacked by a bear, and if I did what she had told me, I would have been all right. This year, I came back, and I brought my golden shovel. You win a golden shovel for the Liars Contest as your trophy, and I said, I'm just here to tell you about the hardships that I've gone through because I won this contest. And I talked about all this fame I had. It was a grueling tour schedule going all across the nation, lying. The paparazzi were always after me. I didn't have a life of my own. I wasn't private anymore. I started taking lie-enhancing drugs, and there were groupies everywhere. It was awful. It was somewhere in between shooting my cameo in the third Matrix, but before I signed my deal with Nike for their Air Liars, that I met this girl. She had one of those smiles that could stop traffic. But it wasn't one of those kinds of smiles that you take home to your mother. Actually, I don't think there's a whole lot you'd take home to your mother about this girl. But I was young. I was in love. I should have known better. She was always asking me if we went out, if I could bring my golden shovel. She was always asking to hold the golden shovel. But I had no idea. It turned out that she was a Canadian terrorist. I should have seen it, but I just didn't know. Canadian terrorists aren't as so much terrorists, just mean people who got kicked out of Canada for littering or cussing too much. These Canadians had formed a group that wanted to take over West Virginia. One night, she brought me to their bunker, and what they wanted me to do was spread their lies as the truth, because I'm such a good liar, all across West Virginia, so that the West Virginia people start drinking milk from a bag and saying A instead of what. And I didn't know anything was wrong until they showed me their policing uniforms, Royal Mountie uniforms, blue and gold, West Virginia's colors, and something in my head cracked. John Denver started singing Country Roads. I just couldn't take it anymore. I grabbed my shovel, and I fought my way out of there. Oh, I was hitting them left. And, well, actually, fighting Canadian terrorists aren't that hard. They're not good fighters. The next day, I came back with an army of West Virginia fiddlers, West Virginia guitar players, and every kind of person I could find, and we chased those Mounties back to the north. In the future, I really see myself being involved in politics somehow, and I know that's kind of funny. For a young, ambitious future politician, this is about the best award you can get. But in all seriousness, I'd really like to do something in politics or journalism. By the time I get to have a job, everybody's going to forget about all this lying that's going on right now in the news and all the journalists who have been caught lying. I figure that it's about time for another young journalist to start making up stories.
Justin Wood will be a senior at George Washington High School in Charleston, West Virginia next year. At least that's what he tells us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.